I'd like for you to turn with me to the book of Daniel, right there in the first chapter, and just begin reading there. We're not going to read the whole thing, but we'll read a little portion of it, and then I want to comment on it. But it starts off by saying, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, this would be approximately 605 B.C., and then this was the first of three invasions by Nebuchadnezzar. The second one was in 597 B.C., and the third was in 587 B.C. So the Babylonians' invasion of Judah and their taking of captives didn't happen in all one fell swoop. It was over a period of time and through multiple invasions, multiple events. That's why you find some cases one prophet is in the captivity, while another prophet, in the case of Ezekiel and Jeremiah, for example, the other prophet is still in the land. So this is the way it happened. Now, obviously, this is correct. The author of this document here, we call the Book of Daniel, is correct in his dates. He understands what year it was. But the controversy surrounding it, and this is not going to be the main part of the sermon today, but the controversy surrounding it can be found in just about any theological institution today, when you'll have people telling you that obviously Daniel, when you go, especially when you look later in the book and see some of the prophecies, particularly those prophecies pertaining to the second century BC, to the time of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, then the general thinking is, among most, I would say, in the especially among the so-called higher critics in the world of theology, would tell you that Daniel was written in the 2nd century B.C., long after the 6th century, which, it, according to Daniel himself, according to the book itself, that's when it was written. But in any case, I'm not going to belabor that and go into that, but just to say very briefly that there are all kinds of good sources out there, good essays, good books written especially by certain evangelical scholars who have looked at this, examined the data, the information that's commonly used and has been used for a long time to try to show a late date. It doesn't really work out, and they support an early dating for Daniel. In other words, he really did live in the 6th century B.C., and he really did prophesy these things. So I won't belabor it beyond that, except perhaps to take up that theme a little later when we get into some of the visions. But for now, I just want to look at how this starts off. It tells us that Daniel was among these captives, Daniel and also his friends, Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, whose names were changed to give, they were given the Babylonian names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so these four, Daniel and his three friends, are mentioned here by name, and we're told that they were among those young people that were brought into the king's palace, the young men that the king wanted to use. And this, of course, is a wise thing on the part of ancient kings. They didn't just take people captive and keep them in bondage, in severe bondage, and keep them in chains. They used them in their courts, in their kingdom. And they even gave them positions of responsibility. You see that happening with Joseph when he was in Egypt. And you see it happening with Daniel here. Daniel and his three young men, along with him, his friends, came into the king's palace, and they were to be enculturated. They were to be taught the language of the Babylonians, the literature of the Babylonians, learn all about Babylonian, the Babylonian life and the culture, and be brought into it and then be made useful members of Babylonian society, even though they retain their Hebrew identity. And so that's what's happened here, and there's nothing in particular wrong with that. And they go along with it. They don't resist it. They're good citizens. What else can you do in a situation like that? But then something kind of interesting happens, and that is when the king determines that he's going to share his delicacies and his wine and good, and no doubt, the food and wine the king had was the best, the very best you could find anywhere. And he is going to share his delicacies and his wine with these young men that he's brought into his palaces. And Daniel says, no. You're wondering why. If you read the story, we'll just summarize it for you here. So he asks the chief eunuch, says, no, we don't want to defile ourselves with the king's food or with the king's wine. Now, listen, this is not some hidden secret here that somebody can write a book about, even though they have, about the Daniel diet. It's not saying that he has some kind of hidden wisdom that nobody else had, and he knew about what God's the true health laws were. And, of course, as it turns out, they went vegan. And no, that's not really what this is about. And it's not about that at all. It's not about going back to the Edenic diet, the original diet, you know, fruits and vegetation and that sort of thing. No, it's about something. He says we won't defile ourselves, not only with the king's food. You might think, well, that's because it was unclean. Much of it was, but surely not all of it was. Babylonians ate ruminants, you know, sheep, goats, cattle, things like that. So surely they could have picked out those things and eaten those things, not the big hog with the apple in his mouth on the table there. But in any case, no, he says, no, just vegetables and water. You think, what is that about? We don't want to defile ourselves, not only with his food, but also with his wine. Well, what's wrong with that? Unless you're going to, you know, get inebriated, what's wrong with the use of a little wine? It's probably the finest in the kingdom, too. But he said, no, we don't want any of that. We only want vegetables and water. And the eunuch is concerned, the chief eunuch who's in charge of all of this and supplying the food and everything, he says, and he knows he could get in trouble. Because he says, you know, the king comes in and takes a look at you fellas. He looks at all the other guys and sees they're healthy. And then here you are with that vegan look. He didn't put it in those words, but you know what I'm talking about. You've seen them. You used to see them working in health food stores all the time. They have that look about it, all sunken, circles around their eyes and all of that, because they're not getting the nutrition they need. They need to be eating meat, but they're not. The answer I always give to people who complain about that says, vegans. I always tell them, I said, look, if God did not intend for us to eat animals, why did he make them out of meat? But anyway, yeah. And I tell them I never eat anything with a face because I always cut that off. But anyway, but the point, there's a point here, though. Here, Daniel is being enculturated. He and his friends are being brought into Babylonian culture and society, and yet he won't eat the delicacies of the king. Why is that? And it could be, of course, because the unkosher aspect of some of these foods that the king was offering. But more than that, there's something else here. To be in the world is different from being of the world. And to begin to eat the delicacies, food from the king's own table, wine from the king's own wine vats, whatever, however you stored the wine or wine containers, is to kind of have a different relationship with the king, wouldn't you say? Is to change the relationship, change the dynamic. And of course, many people would go for that right away, and that way they're subjecting themselves to a certain influence. But what you see here is Daniel and his friends are drawing a line and saying, we are cooperative, we're living in this world of ungodliness, this world very different from the one God wanted us to live in. And so we're cooperative, we're agreeable as far as we can be agreeable, we're respectful, but we draw the line. We're in the world, but not of the world. So they remained their distinctiveness, their separateness. Their identity was grounded not in the Babylonian king and his delicacies and all that he had to offer, but their distinctiveness, their identity, their lives were grounded in the living God. And that is the point here. The message to us is live in the world, we have to, but do not be of the world. A powerful message, and you see this repeated throughout Daniel. You see some major themes coming out of this. And the book of Daniel is not just about prophecies about things that are coming, things that are going to happen, something you can put on a chart and work out, when is the rapture going to occur and what is the rapture and all of that. It's much more to it than that. It's a very encouraging book because you find these young men, Daniel in particular, but also his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they represent the faithful remnant. You find them in captivity. Now, this addresses a question that's always come to mind in the past, and that is simply this. You have God, when He made the covenant with Israel, and He tells them, if you're faithful, you as a nation, you're faithful to the covenant, then I'll give you these blessings. All these blessings I will pour out upon you. I will defend you from your enemies. I will keep diseases away from you. But if you disobey me and break my commandments and my statutes, my judgments, disregard the covenant, then I'll let your enemies in the gates. I'll let them overtake you. I will allow them. In other words, I'll withdraw the protective barriers and let the enemies do what the enemies would do without those protective barriers. And they will take you into captivity. And that's what we see happening. But you know, the question that comes to mind is that what about the faithful remnant? God lets them go into captivity as well. He let Ezekiel go into the captivity. He lets Daniel go into the captivity. And there they are in the captivity, even though they've been faithful. Well, there's a reason for that. And that brings us to the other theme that is emphasized in the book of Daniel in relationship to this, and that is that God is sovereign. When you look around and you see you're in a condition, a situation that you don't understand, or when the remnant looks around, the people of God look around and say, why is God letting us end this situation? We don't necessarily have the answers right away. We know what God can do in delivering us out of it. We don't always have the assurance that He will do that. But we know what He can do. But we have to remember through it all that He is in charge. He's in charge. That's why you have over and over here the emphasis on the kingdom, God's kingdom. His dominion is everlasting. It is from generation to generation. You see Nebuchadnezzar learning that lesson when he's sent out into the wild and behaves as a wild animal. And when he comes back, he realizes his kingdom is from generation to generation. His dominion is forever. He appoints kings and he deposes kings. Doesn't mean, by the way, he micromanages history. Doesn't mean that every time we have a new president in office that God put him there. Doesn't mean that. You know, we can make those mistakes ourselves. God doesn't have to put the lowest of men there. Sometimes we do that. But it says that He does. He gives the kingdom to whoever He wills, whoever He chooses, even from the basest of men. But again, it doesn't mean He micromanages history. It does mean, however, that He is over it all. He is in control. And therefore, if you're among the faithful remnant, you know that in the end, all will be well. Regardless what happens to you in the meantime. If you're among the faithful remnant, then it is the message to you is, be not fearful. God's in charge. And you see this. You see Daniel and his friends living this out in their lives. You go on over a couple of chapters, let's say to chapter 3, and you see Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You see what happens to them when Nebuchadnezzar, even after declaring the greatness of God, when Daniel was able to give him the meaning of the vision that he had, the dream vision, nevertheless, he still... He wants a little of the glory himself, so he makes a big golden image of himself. And he commands the people to bow down to it. Bow down before the image of the beast, if you will. And you got these three young men who say, no. No. And what happens to, you know the story. They get thrown into the fiery furnace. Well, what they said was, that God is able, for we know, they said, we know that God is able to deliver us. They didn't know for sure that He would, but they knew He was able. And so they were cast into the fiery furnace. Of course, it tells the story is made seven times hotter than usual because the king was really mad about these three that wouldn't bow down before him or his image. And even some of the guards, some of the people who threw them in got burned up. And then he looks in there and he sees these three guys walking around with the fourth, who is one who's like the Son of Man. And then they later tell him that he sent his angel to deliver them. They were delivered from that situation. So again, what do you have here? The message to the remnant, the faithful remnant, is to live in the world, but not to be of the world. You have to draw the line at that point where you step over into the world, into that part of the world that is contradictory to what God calls upon you, the way of life He calls upon you to live. So to bow down before an idol, an image like that, to serve it, I suppose you could have justified it, said, well, I'm not really worshiping God in my heart, but I'm going to go ahead. No, they didn't want people to think, even to think, that they were bowing down in that way to Nebuchadnezzar's image, thus acknowledging him as a god, giving him divine status. They didn't want to send that message with what they were doing in their lives. So they said no. And so here you see again, knowing that God was sovereign, in charge, and that they need not be fearful, even though they might be thrown into the fire and might be burned up, they knew God could deliver. And of course, fortunately, God did. And then we go on to yet another event, another occasion in chapter 6, when Daniel was now, this was during the reign of Darius the Mede. Now keep in mind that all these visions didn't happen at one time. And if you look up the dates on when these visions were given, you see they happen over a course of time. The first one, Daniel was a young man when Nebuchadnezzar had his dream image. And then as you read through the different prophecies, you see, or the different sections of the book, you see that there's mention made of who was the king at the time. And you see that in some cases many years had passed. So these various visions and the various events that are recorded here happened over a period of a long time. And by the time you get toward the end of the book, Daniel is an old man. He's up in his 80s. Has to be at least in his 80s, at least 80, probably older. But in any case, this is what you see here. And as we will see a little bit later, by that time he has an awful lot to think about. But you see Daniel rising in the kingdom. He's becoming, he's giving greater appointments of responsibility. And he gets crossways because of this with some of the other governors. And so they work out a plot against him. And the reason they do this is because they know the man. He has a reputation. They know about his devotion, what he's devoted to. And so they proposed to the king that a law be signed that for 30 days no one would be allowed to petition a god or a man. And they knew they had Daniel on this because Daniel would petition his god. Here again, this is where he draws the line. They knew he'd draw the line there. And so sure enough, he does, and they're watching, and they catch him praying. And they throw him, he signed it into law. So he basically reasons he has no choice but to follow what he has decreed. So, and he regrets it, he doesn't want to do it, but he does it, throws him into the lion's den. And he goes out the next day, calling out to Daniel with hopes, but it sounds like not really a lot of hope anyway. And he calls out to him, and Daniel answers. He's still in there. The lions haven't harmed him. So this again, this tells you, this says when you find yourself in tribulation in a world of ungodliness, you still have to remember who your God is. You must never turn away from that. It's a simple message, but it's powerful, especially when you put it in these accounts and see how these are men who lived out that. They were true to that. You know, we can give it lip service, but sometimes when we're up against it, as it were, then we may find ourselves faltering. But these guys didn't, and Daniel didn't. He went into the lion's den. And it says that the angel, God sent his angel, stopped the mouths of the lions, and he came out just fine. So you see these things happening. And we see that in these things that the remnant, represented by Daniel and his friends, they were in the world, but not of the world. And that's why this book of Daniel is a timeless message for us, for the people of God today. Always. It's timeless. It's not something that belongs only to history. Just some interesting reading there. It's a message to us, a powerful message, that we're to be in the world, but not of the world. And then it goes on, and I'd like to back up here a little bit and go back to some of the visions. I'm not going to read through all of them, but I'll summarize them. You remember back in chapter 2, there was Nebuchadnezzar's dream image. He'd had the dream. The image had a head of gold, the chest and arms of silver, its belly and sides of bronze or brass, and its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And then Daniel interprets this. Not only does he interpret it, he tells him what the image, what the dream was. The astrologers and soothsayers and magicians and Chaldeans and other people in Nebuchadnezzar's court couldn't tell him that. But Daniel could. He told him what the dream was, and then he gave it its interpretation. He says, "You're the head of gold." Not meaning you personally. What is the king without his kingdom? He's talking about not the king, not just the king apart from his kingdom, but the king and his kingdom. So you're the head of gold. Of course, there's another kingdom to follow. He shows this is a succession of kingdoms. The second one, the arms and the chest of silver, was a kingdom that would come after, and we recognize that as the what we would call the Medo-Persian kingdom. But here it gets interesting when you go into the world of scholarship, because they will say, well, this was Media. The second one was Media. And you know why they do that? Say this: the second was Media. The third one, the belly of and sides of brass, that represents Persia. And then the fourth one, the legs of iron, that's the Grecian kingdom. In time you get down to the feet, part of iron, part of clay, that's the final stages of the Grecian kingdom. That's where Antiochus Epiphanes comes in. Do you know why they do that? The end of the day, why they do it? They would deny it. They say, oh, no. But in spite of denials, the reason they do that, because if you recognize that the fourth kingdom was the Roman Empire, then you have Daniel, who allegedly wrote in the second century, about 165 BC, knowing about Rome. And that's a problem. So you got to back it up and make the fourth kingdom the Grecian kingdom. A problem you get into that, though, is by separating Media and Persia, it never did work out that way. Just read through the book of Daniel, you see the Medes and the Persians mentioned together. The Medes ruled under the Persians. They were always subordinate to the Persians. So you had the Medo-Persian kingdom represented in the second kingdom. And the third one was the Grecian kingdom. And the fourth one, obviously, just look at the description. It fits the Roman kingdom more than anything else. Now, I think that's very important. The reason I do, I'll get to in just a little while. But I'll just mention this first, and that is, if you lay over each other the different visions, and you look at this same succession taking place, succession of empires, from the Neo-Babylonian Empire to the Medo-Persian to the Greco-Macedonian, and finally the Roman, you will see that they match up. And then when you come to the end, there's something, come to the very last chapters, after it describes Antiochus Epiphanes, then you have this continuing discussion going on there, and we'll get to it in just a little while. We'll get to it. And this is where the scholars would tell you that Daniel got it all wrong. I'm saying, no, he didn't. He hit the nail right on the head, because they're misreading it, in my opinion. But anyway, we go on to another vision, and that is the second similar vision he had. quite a bit later. And this is one Daniel himself received, and it's in chapter 7. And this tells us that this vision came in the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. This would have been about 552 B.C. 552. So we're moving on here. Some time has passed. 552. In other words, it's about maybe 50 years after Nebuchadnezzar's dream image. So the long space between these two prophecies. And this one came, and Daniel sees, again, I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but he sees these four beasts coming up. One of them, they come up out of the sea, and they're different from each other. The first one is like a lion, the eagle's wings. That obviously represents the Neo-Babylonian Empire. But here comes the second one, and you have the same succession here taking place. The second one is described a little bit differently, and it said, well, let me go ahead and read what it says. The second like a bear, is raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. So you can look back in history and see how this fits with the Medo-Persian Empire. The fact that it was raised up on one side may indicate, as we'll see another prophecy a little bit that corresponds with this, may indicate the higher side may represent Persia, and the lower side Media, meaning Medo-Persian kingdom. And it says, after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads. That's interesting. Four heads, and dominion was given to it. This would be the Grecian kingdom. And what are those four heads? We're going to see this a little bit more in depth in chapter 8, but those four heads would represent the four, well, the, when Alexander's kingdom, when he established his kingdom, when he, with his blitzkrieg style, spread his kingdom, the Grecian kingdom, all over the world, because of his death, well, his kingdom got carved into four. These four heads represent those four sections of the Grecian kingdom. Are those four aspects. He says, after this in the night vision, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had strong teeth. Now, again, many of in the world of scholarship would say this fourth beast is really the Grecian kingdom, and they make it fit. They make it fit the Grecian kingdom. I'll show you how they do that. He says it had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from the other beasts and were before it, and it had 10 horns. These are said to be the 10 horns or the 10 kings of the Seleucid dynasty. That's in the Grecian kingdom. And it says, and I considered the horns, and there another horn, a little one. This is the little horn coming up among them, before whom three of the other fell, and so forth. And it goes on to say he had a mouth speaking pompous words. This would be Antiochus the Fourth, the Seleucid of the Seleucid kingdom, and this still belongs under the heading of Grecian period. But no, this is not what it's talking about. That's not what it's talking about at all. Again, I'm not going to get into all the explanations of it, but clearly if the third beast is the Grecian kingdom, then the fourth beast is not. It's the kingdom that came afterward, and it is, in fact, the Roman kingdom. And again, there's an important reason for understanding the fourth beast and the fourth section, the fourth kingdom, in all of these visions, being the Roman kingdom, because there's something else happened then. Something else extremely significant, especially to the remnant. It's especially meaningful to the remnant of God's people, the faithful remnant. You see it back in the dream image of Nebuchadnezzar. You know what happened to it. There was a stone cut out of the mountain without hands and struck the image on the feet. And the whole thing, representing the kingdoms of this world, crumbled. And that then, from that stone, was established an everlasting kingdom that wasn't turned over to other people. There was no successor after that kingdom. It's forever. What is that? Who is that stone, do you think? Does it point to a certain individual? I think it does. And then when you get to the four beasts, the prophecy of the four beasts, it doesn't end with just describing the beasts. It goes on to tell you about a certain time of judgment. I'm going to skip over some of this and go into verse 13. It says, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. Is that familiar language? He came to the Ancient of Days. That would be God, God the Father. And they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. This reminds you of something else. The first vision, the stone cut out without hands out of the mountain, striking the image. Well, this is very similar. It says it was given to him a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. That doesn't fit very well at the end of the third kingdom, does it? The Grecian kingdom. Not at all. And it goes on, when Daniel receives the explanation of these visions, we're told in verse 25, towards 25, says, he shall speak pompous words. This is talking about that little horn that comes out of the Roman kingdom. Well, remember, there are two little horns here. You're going to see in chapter 8, there's a little horn that comes out of the Grecian kingdom. But here in this chapter, you see there's a little horn that comes up out of the Roman kingdom. These are two different little horns. And what people do, they confuse the two and assumes that it's all talking about a Grecian little horn. But no, this is still talking about the fourth beast. Says, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall indeed intend to change times and law, that the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom, this looks back to verses 13 and 14, where the one like the Son of Man is given the kingdom and the authority over the peoples and the kingdoms and the nations and languages, says, then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. Some people say, well, that's the people of Israel by and large. No, this is the remnant. This is the remnant. They're the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Now, again, though, some people say, well, that means the Son of Man figure over in verses 13 and 14 is symbolic of the nation of Israel as a whole. No, they use this verse here that I just read to show that that's how it's full, that is to say this is referring to the nation of Israel as a whole. No, it's referring to the remnant of Israel, the faithful remnant, the Daniels, and the Shadrachs and Meshachs and Abednegoes, not to the nation as a whole. And it is to them that's given this authority, but however, they do have a king. He's described as a stone cut out of the mountain without hands. He's described here as the Son of Man coming before the Ancient of Days. He is the king of the remnant. The remnant are the people who are already under the reign of the king because they already obey him. They're the ones who draw the line. They're in the world, but not of the world. So if we're in that group, then we are in a phase of the kingdom of God now. It's just we don't have the final phase. That's what we're looking forward to. And so when people say, I've heard the different explanations for these prophecies, like the stone cut out without hands, striking the image on the feet, well, does that pertain to the first century when Christ came, or does it the second coming? I used to always think solely in terms of the second coming, but now I say, no, it's both. Christ did come in the first century, in the Roman period. That's very important to understand that. But he didn't accomplish everything he is going to accomplish then. He's still working with a remnant. In fact, it was a remnant that received the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. And it was a remnant. The remnant expanded as the gospel was preached, as more and more people came to repentance. And then the remnant expanded further. Gentiles were added to it. People from all the nations and tongues and tribes and peoples. There were Asians. There were Africans. People from all over the world were being added to the remnant. So this pertains to those people, the faithful, not to unfaithful Israel, not to Israel as a whole, unless you describe Israel as a whole as the people in whom the Spirit of God dwells. So to them, under the reign of the Son of Man, is given the kingdom. Now then, with that, I want to go on to chapter 8. Chapter 8, this is a very interesting vision. The ram and the he-goat, and you may wonder, why does he put this in here and emphasize these two kingdoms that come in the middle? Because that's what this is about. And you will see the answer to that as you read through this detailed explanation of what all of this means. In chapter 8, you have, it was in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. That's about 550 or 51, somewhere along in there, B.C. And Daniel has a vision. And he says, I saw in the vision, it happened while I was... While I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had horns, and two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, and that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. Now, what's the explanation for this? The explanation is found when Gabriel comes and interprets it for him. Gabriel says that the ram, verse 20, the ram which you saw having the two horns are the two kings of Media and Persia. Obviously, the higher horn coming up in the Persia. This is the Medo-Persian kingdom. Let's continue reading. And I was considering, as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram, which had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him and attacked the ram and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Who is this? Well, Gabriel answers the question. He says, verse 21, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. So there you have your descriptions here. You have Medo-Persia, the Medo-Persian kingdom, and then this followed by the Grecian kingdom. It says the large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. That would be Alexander the Great. Now, I don't know that this is true, or it can possibly be confirmed, but it has been said, as there's a claim out there. May have been invented later, who knows. But there's a claim that Alexander, when he came through, was shown this. He was told that he's named here. He mentioned. And I guess he was kind of proud of it. They probably didn't show him the part about the horn getting broken, though. So I don't know if there's any truth to that or not. But anyway, that's the claim that's out there. It says, as for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise. I didn't read that part back here, but that's what happens in the vision. The four stands up in its place. It says, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation. This parallels with the four heads in the third beast that you see in the previous vision. Four kingdoms shall rise out of this nation, but not with its power. So they'll be weakened compared to the power that Alexander expressed when he was leading the charge. It says, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features. Now this is the little horn that came up from one of those horns. And this is the fierce king having fierce features. It says, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. And you can read about that. And if you have, I don't know how many of you have an apocryphal or have the deuterocanonical texts, or if you have a Catholic Bible, in 1 Maccabees 1 and verses 54 through 63. That's the account of Antiochus Epiphanes. That's who he's talking about here. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken without human means. You can read about that in 2 Maccabees 9 and verses 1 through 28. He was cut off from life very suddenly. He was very angry, very mad because of what some of the Jewish resistance had done. This was in the Maccabean period when a remnant of the people were resisting the evil reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. Remember, this is the guy who burnt swine's flesh on the altar in the temple and who put a statue of Zeus in the temple. That did not set well with the Jews who lived there. Especially the remnant, the righteous remnant, who lived in that area and were among the Jewish people at that time. And they did come up with a very successful resistance. But anyway, as due to some of the things that happened, Antiochus was very angry and he was going to Jerusalem. He intended to turn Jerusalem into a Jewish cemetery. But on the way, he fell ill suddenly. It died a very miserable death, according to the account in 2 Maccabees. Very miserable death. He was so suffering to the point that he says, God, if you'll deliver me, I'll become a Jew. Of course, he didn't get delivered, and he didn't become a Jew. But in any case, that's where he died, and that's what this is referring to here. And the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which you were told are true, therefore seal up the vision, for it is for many days yet. Now then... Now we come to Daniel's prayer, and I want to notice something about this that's particularly important, I would say. It says, in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus. Darius, this was 537 B.C. So quite a bit of time had passed. Quite a bit of time, 537. From 605 when he first got there to 537. Now, so you can see, you can begin to see how old he is. So he says in the first year of his reign, verse 2, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the work of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet, and he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. You know what he's talking about, the prophecy in Jeremiah. He sent them into the captivity. He says it's for 70 years. Jerusalem will be trodden underfoot. You will be in the captivity for 70 years. Again, the date here, it's dated. We know it was 537 B.C. And here Daniel, he's thinking. And he's about to launch into a prayer, very, very obviously emotional prayer. Why is that? What's he thinking about? Well, he's doing a little math. 70 years. Let's see, 6, 5, 37. He may not have had our calendar, but he knew how to count years. They're within a couple of years of the end of the captivity. And now he's had these visions, and these visions do indeed tell him about Cyrus, the Medo-Persian kingdom, and it is under Cyrus that the people will go back to the land. And he's living there. He's living in this time. And he knows this is going to happen soon. And so he's praying about it, and yet at the same time, think about it. Not only does he know that the time is near, that they will go back, the reconstruction will begin, they'll build again the temple, they'll begin sacrificing and restore the priesthood, restore the worship of God. And yet there's some other factors, though, that are there that he's cranked into his thinking. One of which is, the Grecians are coming. What are you going to do with that? Wait a minute, we're going back to rebuild, aren't we? And yet you're telling us that once we rebuild, that they're going to tear it down again? And we got more trouble, more tribulation? And so you can understand why he cries out to God. Why he says, he begs God and for answers. He's asking for answers. He's praying. He says, "Oh Lord, righteousness belongs to you. But to us," verse 7, "shame of face," that is this day, "to the men of Judah, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and all Israel, those near and far away, far off, in all the countries to which you have driven them." So he's confessing. He goes on to confess his own sins and their sins because he knows they're a sinful people, and he knows these things come upon them because of their transgressions. And he's begging for God's mercy, and he also wants answers. And then the answers come to him in another very interesting vision called the 70 weeks prophecy. Actually, literally, it means 77s. 77s. It's not really 70 weeks, it's 77s, meaning what does that mean exactly? Well, he's been praying. What his prayer has been about revolves around Jeremiah's prophecy of 70 years, so the 77s must be refer to years, not days, not actual literal weeks. 70 times 7, that's 490 years. So this is the 70 weeks prophecy. So the angel comes to him and reveals and gives him this in answer to his prayer. And he says, 70 weeks, verse 24, "are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end to sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up visions and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy." Now you could look at each one of those items and you could apply it to the rebuilding of the temple and starting the sacrificial system again and all of that, and so many people do, especially dispensationalists, they will interpret it that way. But there's a deeper meaning here. There's a deeper meaning here. This is not pointing merely to the temple, the restoration of the temple. It's pointing beyond that. It's pointing to what all of that stood for from the beginning. To finish the transgression. Make an end of sins. In other words, true atonement is coming. "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem..." Different dates have been given for this. There were three different commands, but I'm not going to get into it because it's so much because maybe it, probably I'll say it's the command of Ahasuerus, the second command. I think it was from what's his name? Anyway, the Persian ruler, because it was more official. And if you do the math on this, even if you look at some of the other commands or somewhere in that general time frame of when these commands to restore, to let the people go, send them back, restore the city and so on, if you look, it brings you down to a certain time, not in the Grecian kingdom. Count 490 years from this time when the command went out, regardless when that command was, the exact date on it, but it takes you to the general time frame of about 30 A.D., Did something happen long in that general time frame that's very important? I think so. But he goes on, he says, "from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince." Some say, "Oh, no, this is just talking about some anointed one." Well, look at it, overlay it with these other things we've looked at. The stone cut out without hand, fourth kingdom. Son of Man, fourth beast, fourth kingdom. And now here you have 490 years takes you out to the fourth kingdom, Roman Empire. And you have this Messiah, the Prince, coming at that time. So what do you think? Is this messianic or not? Well, of course it is. Of course it is. "There shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, or seven sevens and 62 sevens, that's a total of 69 sevens. "The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. And after the 62 weeks," that's after the 69, the 483 years in other words, "Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself." parenthetical statement here. Don't apply this to Messiah. Parenthetical statement. And the people of the prince who is to come, that's some other prince, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. That's a parenthetical statement. Who does it pertain to and what does it pertain to? The destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. Titus was the prince of the who was to come. He, the end of the parenthesis right there, he, now we're back to the Messiah, he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to the sacrifice and offering. How does he do that? What happened when he was crucified? The temple veil was rent, exposing the most holy place, making it unfit for sacrifices until it could be repaired and all of that. But this is, you know, that's. But more than that, he makes an end to sacrifices in the sense that he is that ultimate sacrifice that all of that pointed to begin with. This is the true atoning sacrifice that is made. And then on the wings of abominations, looking back again to the prince who is to come, at some point after this, not inside the 77s, but some point afterward, and on the wings of abominations shall be one who makes desolate even unto the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. So Titus would come, and you see the parallel, of course, between this event and what Antiochus the Fourth did in destroying the temple and desecrating the temple. And so Titus, his armies did. They did just that. So you see how this all brings us to the fourth kingdom. And without a doubt, I have no doubt that this anointed one referred to here is Jesus Christ. It's not some, as many scholars would have you believe, some high priest or something. It is a high priest, but not some high priest in the Levitical line or in the Levitical priesthood. And now then, you come over to chapter 11. I'll try to finish this up pretty quickly and summarize it. I don't want to go deeply into it, but in chapter 11, you see what he's begun there back in chapter 8 when he's talking about the Medo-Persian Empire being succeeded by the Grecian kingdom and then the little horn. Well, he expounds that in chapter 11. And again, I'm not going to go into it in detail, but you see there is a lot of detail here, very detailed, and this is why so many scholars say, how could he have had all those details of things that would happen in the second century unless he lived there to see it and to know it? Either he was living during this period or immediately thereafter, and so when he wrote this and put the name Daniel on it, don't know who it was, but he put the name Daniel on it, he obviously had this information available to him. But I'm thinking, okay, even if that's true, even if that were true, I don't accept that, but even if it were true, you still got to deal with this Roman kingdom. How do you know about that? Because you see, the scholars will tell you, many of the scholars will tell you, that because of the details you see in chapter 11 concerning Antiochus Epiphanes and this succession of the Syrian kings in the Seleucid dynasty, it is so detailed and so accurate. But there's something else here, they will tell you, that happens afterward, and he goes off the tracks and he's wrong, therefore he must have been writing in the second century. And then speculating about what would happen thereafter. And this is where he goes off the rails, they say. This is where he gets the historical flow wrong. It begins in verse 36. Then the king shall do according to his own will, and he shall exalt and magnify himself. Now what's he been talking about? He's been talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. All through chapter 11, he's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. But before we get into verse 36, let's read the previous verse here, maybe a couple of verses. Verse 34, now when they fall, they shall be added with a little help, aided with little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. This, and again, he's talking about when the statue of Jupiter Olympus is put in the temple and so on. It says, and some of those of understanding shall fall. And here's a very important verse, to refine them. Those of understanding, the Daniels of that period, the Shadrachs, Meshachs, and Abednegoes, the righteous remnant, they were still there during this period, the 2nd century B.C., which is the time it's referring to refine them, purify them, and make them white. You see, that's the purpose for God allowing the remnant to go into captivity with the rest of the nation. To the rest of the nation, it's punishment for their sins. To the remnant, it's refinement, it's purification. You see how Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego all were refined through their experience of living in an ungodly world and yet drawing the line and saying, we will go no further, we will not go beyond that line because we serve the living God. And when there's a conflict between our king and our God, God wins. We obey God rather than men. So they're being refined. But you know, remember the prophecy itself. It talks about that little horn coming to his end, being broken without human means. Just because it doesn't spell it out here doesn't mean that that's not in Daniel's thought. His last thought here is talking about the refinement of those who fall, the righteous ones who fall during that period. And then he says in verse 36, and this is where he supposedly goes off the rails, then the king shall do according to his own will. Are we still talking about Antiochus the Fourth? Are you sure that we're talking about Antiochus the Fourth? Because remember, throughout Daniel you have this succession of kings. So the king shall do, whoever the king is at this time, the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, and shall blaspheme against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers. Wait a minute, you know, this doesn't sound like that little horn is going to get broken. Sounds like he's moved on to another subject, doesn't it? Well, that's because he has. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers. He's already talked about Antiochus and how he regarded God. Nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god with his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Now this, so far, this could apply to just about any pagan king. You know, the wording there, you're not sure at this point. But he goes on and says, at the time of the end, and when we see this expression, it doesn't always mean our time or what's ahead of us. It could be the time of the end of an era, which is also the beginning of something new, something very significant. The time of the end of the old era, now then something new is about to happen. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. This would be the Egyptians. And the king of the north shall come against him. Is this still talking about Antiochus? I say no. No, not now. Like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Have you ever heard of an ambitious young Roman named Octavian? He took the name Augustus Caesar. Have you ever read in a history book the story of Mark Antony and Cleopatra and of Octavian or Augustus Caesar? He's describing it right here. I have to give credit to an author, John M. Oakes. He's actually a Church of Christ elder He wrote a book entitled Daniel, Prophet to the Nations. And he brought that out. Something I hadn't thought about before, but he shows how that fits that period to a T. And it does. What did Augustus Caesar do in Egypt? You remember how Mark Antony and Cleopatra committed suicide? Because they knew what was going to happen. He would take them back to Rome and march them in procession as the vanquished, and they would be paraded before the Romans as this vanquished queen and so on. They chose death rather than that. And I think he took them back anyway, paraded their bodies. But he was a pretty vile fellow in many regards. But in any case, this is talking about, again, this takes us to the Roman period. The Roman period. And of course, it looks beyond that as well. Well, first of all, he says, verse 41, he shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, and these shall escape from his hand, Moab, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, which it didn't, of course. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians, he shall follow on his heel. You know, he was the first, technically or officially, the first Roman emperor. Julius Caesar was not. This was Caesar's adopted son. Julius Caesar, I think it was actually, his grandson? But anyway, Octavian was. And so Octavian, having these ambitions, probably kind of runs in the family. But anyway, he had these political ambitions, and when he came of age, he exerted them. He seized power from the Senate and transformed the Roman Republic into the Roman Empire. So officially he was the first emperor. And he did all of these things described right here. Of course, again, as I said, it doesn't end there, because the Roman Empire didn't end there. It says, but news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And so on as it goes. But then it goes on down in chapter 12. It says, at that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of our people. And it shall be a time of trouble such as never was seen. He takes us to the end of the matter by saying in verse 2, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth. Don't put this on a timetable. He's talking about ultimate things here, meaning his emphasis is on this is what awaits the faithful. Those who draw the line, the faithful remnant. Many who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are the wise, the Daniels, shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So that's the hope that's held out before them, the Daniels of the remnant. But again, this is all in a context that belongs to, or it fits, the rise of the fourth kingdom. Now again, back to the time of Octavian, the time of Augustus Caesar. There was a very important event that took place along in that general time frame. It was a few miles south of Jerusalem in a little town, Bethlehem. A child was born. A son was given. And the government would rest upon his shoulders. And there would be no end to his kingdom like all the other kingdoms. And of course, we know who that is. This is the stone cut out without hands. This is the Son of Man who's given authority over all nations and tongues and tribes and peoples. This is the Messiah who is cut off in the midst of the weak. It's the Messiah who will reign forever. And the message to us through all of this is that we have the opportunity to shine with him as the stars forever and ever, to be a part of His kingdom, of His reign. That's what we're called to do. That's what our job is in becoming. We're looking for that goal, for that outcome. And to obtain it, we must be like the Daniels and the Shadrachs, and the Meshachs and Abednegoes of the remnant. We have to draw the line. We have to be respectful. We have to be cooperative with the powers of this world. But we recognize we live in an ungodly world. And we have to draw the line. At a certain point, we say, no, we will not step over the line. For we serve our God, not humans. He's our God. He's our ruler. We have a king who's on a throne next to power, at the right hand of God the Father Himself. He's coming again, but He's our king now. We will obey Him rather than men.